And it's one more piece from Leonard Erickson, and we'll go to the phone calls. I agree with Richard O'Keefe's comments in Risks, Volume 11, Number 58. Several of the well-known holes are exactly equivalent to well-known holes with locks. For example, a certain major brand of bicycle lock can be picked with a piece of bent wire in approximately 5 seconds, as I once demonstrated to an employer who was going to use one to secure some valuable items. Likewise, many operating systems have equally bad shortcomings in their security if you are knowledgeable. The user should only have limited responsibility for operating system holes, especially since, as many have noted, there may be nothing they can do about it. If, for example, you're running a TRS-80 Model 1, you cannot fix the holes in its operating system. It would cost more than the entire system is worth. And if you are using such an old item, you either are broke or have a very compelling reason. On the other hand, you had better not be counting on it being secure. Ignorance may be forgivable the first time. After that, you have no excuse for continuing to keep valuables in an unsafe environment. Default passwords and accounts are a bit different. The user can change those. Just as when you buy a briefcase with a combo lock, you can either change the combo from the factory default, or you can accept responsibility for any unauthorized access. Note, however, that just because I haven't changed the combination on my briefcase, and thus have some responsibility for any resulting losses, that in no way affects the underlying fact that it is wrong to attempt to open my locked briefcase without permission. Unauthorized use of a password is no different from unauthorized use of a combination. The password may be stupid, but you still have no business messing with the lock. Your curiosity regarding the contents of my briefcase, or even merely as to whether I've changed the combo, does not give you the right to try and find out. Likewise, a cracker's curiosity doesn't give him the right to go where he isn't wanted. What do you think? 212-279-3407 for calls. 212-279-3400 for pledges. As Vangelis fades off into the distance, again, we will be going to phone calls. And presently, we have Steve Jackson coming up. Steve Jackson, of course, was somebody that ran into quite a bit of problems with the whole definition of what hacking is and what is right and what is wrong. Our number is 212-279-3407. And 212-279-3400. We'll be getting to that Steve Jackson interview in just a couple of minutes. But first, we want to know if there are any questions, comments, or that kind of thing out there. The program is off the hook. We're on the air until 6 o'clock in the morning as part of our special marathon programming here on WBAI. Good evening. You're on.
Hello. You have reached reality. The next voice you will hear will be that of Eric Blair.
Hello, this is Eric Blair from Beyond the Pale, and you are in 1984 and counting. Big Brother is well on his way, with perhaps 90% of the public being taken in by the con of the Bush-Reagan oligarchy and the military-industrial enterprise, which will go where no men and women have ever gone before. We are using now an earthling to carry on the discussion. How you doing there? It's always good to hear your program, although at times I think that you're getting to the point of suggesting that we do all kinds of nefarious things. But my only problem is that even earlier today, had you been listening to WBAI, which is a station, the station which I most love and listen to consistently also, although sometimes I double listen to other stations, you know, like WNYC AM and WABC.
Are you going to make reference to
I know what's going on with the rest of the world, and there are some wonderful things happening.
He's not listening to me.
I feel that, and I think you and I and some other of the good people, I call Etta Joy Walker, should have a day or a week or a month of what is freedom of speech in its truest and fullest essence. And I'll leave you with this one thought, that even a person who is totally against what I say, totally on the other side of an issue, I will listen to with respect, and I will mull over what I believe. I will look for new evidence. I will question myself. I will question the other person. I will question other people. I will do everything in my limit to respect that person and then to try to come to even a better understanding of what knowledge is and truth and so forth, you know, because there is the Rashomon effect. Do you have any questions?
Do I have any questions? No, I just want to encourage you to keep doing that.
Well, I am, and I want you to know I got a whistle that is bejeweled. Apparently, it's the first of a kind that has been awarded to a whistleblower, but I think even there are greater whistleblowers than I. We have to be always vigilant, as the Zen people say. You know, you always have to be ready for, shall we say, a blow of this sort or a blow of that sort. You know, nature, you know, doing its number on you, or fellow human beings doing theirs and so forth, the government doing its and so on.
Uh-huh.
But the point is that your program does help us to keep ever vigilant. I mean, as you showed with those different phone company attempts to reach, you know, and how some people are cooperative and some people aren't and so forth like this. I will tell you this, though, that there are members of the staff of WBAI who are allowed to perform as members of WBAI who I don't think have earned the right on the basis of freedom of speech. Now, they may be able to learn.
Well, now, what we encourage you to do then is, you know, show your support during another program.
Well,
write letters.
I mean, I'm an original subscriber to WBAI. You know, I don't sound like an old man, you know, but I am an original subscriber. I've subscribed for almost every one of the 31 years. I stopped when.
And a very familiar voice on the airwaves.
Problem just to show solidarity with him. And unfortunately, it proved to me to be somewhat of a turnaround thing, as some people will understand. But anyway, carry on. I want to hear other people, and I thank you. I hope my little creativity has some impact on the universe. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Right, bye.
212-279-3407. That's our telephone number for calls. But please, let's see those lines light up. I mean, we're jammed over here. You know, we've got the whole switchboard lit up on the call-in side, and there's absolutely no calls coming in on the pledge side. Please show your support for the radio station. Right now, you can't get through on the call-in line, so if you make that call, you know, if you make that pledge, then you'll be able to call in later, you know? But more importantly, you'll be helping us keep up what it is that we're doing. It's that simple. 212-279-3400 to make a pledge, and everybody that calls in will get a free copy along with their pledge of 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, where you can learn all kinds of things that you never knew were possible. And that's no joke. Good evening.
Yes, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, what are your connections to Sprint and NCI? What are you making out of this? How much money?
How much money am I making out of this? Well, I'm sure it was destiny that somebody eventually asked this. I called as a just as an annoyed consumer because, you know, I'll tell you something. There was not a single edit in that whole piece, but I knew they were going to do exactly that. And if you call them now, I invite you to call MCI, call Sprint, and then call AT&T and see who will tell you how to access
the
company.
Yeah, but that is not a judge of a company.
Well, it's a judge of their policies, don't you think?
Not a judge of their service, and you made it clear that you said my case rests, but that's not a judge of the company. AT&T is a much better company than Sprint and MCI. Sprint and MCI have claimed to have tremendous savings when you call them, when you use their services, but you don't get tremendous services. Maybe you may save a couple of pennies now. But their whole advertisements have been, when they first came out, that they're making you make tremendous savings. You don't make tremendous savings. They have been phony to us.
And AT&T has not?
No, because they, whatever charges they have claimed are the charges you get. But Sprint and MCI says you have great, great savings, and you don't have great savings. You may have a couple of pennies or maybe 20 cents or 10 cents, and that's it.
This sounds word for word like a commercial I just saw on TV. But the thing is, I'm not saying who has the lowest prices. I'm talking about one particular aspect of service, and that's how you deal with the competition.
You said that which company was best. The other, that AT&T is not good compared to Sprint and MCI, and you base it only on if they will give you access numbers.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to judge a company.
Which company is best?
First of all, I did not say MCI or Sprint is best. I said judge it by what you have heard. And we heard a company deliberately not tell you a bit of information because that is their corporate policy, not to tell you about the other alternative.
You don't give phone numbers for your competition either. The point is, you don't have to give competition there. If you want to have Sprint and MCI, there's plenty of ways of getting hold of Sprint and MCI because they have advertisements and they have advertisements on TV. You want to call Sprint and MCI, you can call them.
But why?
You don't have to give the phone number to the competition. There's no law saying that, and there's nothing wrong with denying it.
But when you see the company that is number one by far refusing to give any information about the competition, and the competition, which is much smaller, is giving the information about number one, that's got to tell you something about integrity.
There's nothing fallacious. There's nothing phony about not giving access to the other phone company. There's plenty of other ways of getting it.
I'm not accusing them of phoniness. I'm accusing them of just not giving information out, which they really, in my view, should give out. There's a lot of confused people out there.
It has nothing to do with integrity.
I disagree.
With honesty. It has nothing to do with that. You're totally misleading us, or attempting to. There is no connection between that and integrity.
Well, I disagree. I believe the integrity of AT&T has been besmirched by this little demonstration. But I'd like to hear what other people have to say. Thanks for calling.
Take care.
I'll bet I know what his long-distance carrier is. Oh, boy. 212-279-3407 for phone calls. 212-279-3400 for pledges. Please make those pledges. Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, you seem to know a lot about the telephone company, right?
Well, the telephone companies, yeah, there's many of them now.
Okay, this is rather technical. I have many questions, and I'll hang up and let you go. One is, are you aware, and I can't give it out over the air, are you aware that there's a certain code that you can punch where, let's say if you're in someone's house, and you want to get that person's number, because I used to tell people, I think, years ago, that you don't ever put your, you know, home phone number in the glass window or the window that's on your phone, you know, the one that's...
Right.
Because
yeah, that's fairly well known. Now, you're in New York State?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then the number is 958, right? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's known as ANAC, the automatic number something. It's an automatic number announcement. I think that's what it stands for. And that tells you from your local central office what your telephone number is. It's a useful service to have. When you call the operator, she won't tell you what your phone number is for some reason. But I guess it could be used to against somebody if you access a certain phone number somehow and it doesn't belong to you.
Right.
But it's also important that people know that they can get their phone number by doing that. You know, if you're hooking up phone wires and, you know, by your living room or something, and you're trying to figure out which line is coming up, how else are you going to know which line is which?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'm saying, like, if you're in someone's house and they don't know your home phone number, I could say, sir, do you mind if I borrow your phone? And
right.
I'll say I'm calling somebody, I give the guy a quarter.
But sir, you know, there's a much easier way to get the same information. You simply call yourself collect from that phone, and then when the phone bill comes, you've got their phone number on your phone bill.
All right, now let me get that straight. You call yourself collect?
Let's say you're at a friend's house, right? He refuses to tell you what the phone number is, and 958 does not work from his house. You simply say, okay, can I make a collect call, and you have your wife or whatever at home, and she picks up the phone and accepts your collect call from the friend's house. When you get your phone bill, the number that the collect call came from is going to be on the phone bill. Or, a better idea, get one of those personal 800 numbers that only cost about $10 or $20 a month. And when you get your phone bill on that, you just call the 800 number from your friend's house. When you get your 800 phone bill, you'll see the phone number you called from. So there's lots of ways to find out the number.
Right. Okay, you're right. Now, here's another question. I have heard this. This is something similar but a little different.
Okay.
Two questions. One is that if somebody has a Macintosh computer or a fairly good computer has at least 1 megabyte or more, is there some type of way they can tap into the telephone company, into 9X, to get unlisted numbers under somebody? That's one. And two, is there also some type of code or book given out to investigators or whatever for unlisted numbers?
Well, I'm not sure I understand. The first question is what again?
Right, the first question is, let's say you're a person who has a Macintosh computer or an 8 megabyte, a 6 megabyte, a 4 megabyte computer with a phone modem. And I heard that there is some way, but you really have to be pretty good at it, and it's not easy to do. You tap into the telephone company, and you can get actually unlisted telephone numbers that aren't listed.
Well,
and addresses will be addresses because the address is a link to the number and a service address. That's why you get the address.
First of all, you don't need to have a Macintosh or any particular kind of computer. You simply need to have access to a modem, to a terminal, to something that can get you access to another computer. And yes, if you can tap into a particular phone company
codes,
computer,
right?
I'm sorry?
There's certain security codes, right?
Oh yeah, but if they're left in the default settings, or if you're able to social engineer it out of somebody, that means calling somebody and getting them to give you the password. It happens all the time. You can access a particular kind of computer, and there's many different kinds throughout the different phone companies of the world. And
let's say
a
New York telephone.
Okay, you would access a particular computer there. I believe the Elmo system would probably tell you everything you needed to know. And
you could do it by name or number, or just by name. Let's say you don't know number, you don't know address, so you have to go by name or address or something.
Well, I haven't actually ever done this.
Oh, I know that. No, I know that.
I've never actually done this. So I'm not certain that it's the particular system or what the particular command would be, but it's my understanding that if you have particular bits of information, such as the customer's name or the customer's address, it's not hard at all to find unlisted phone numbers. I know several occasions where someone was being harassed, and they would change their phone number, and the people harassing them would be able to call them before the phone company called them and tell them what their new number was going to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm not talking about myself. I don't do stuff like that. I'm talking about more for, like, police work or other types of work. Okay,
well,
what other question?
The police can always find you. that's rule number one. And a private detective, if he's any good, can also always find you.
Yeah, yeah. Unless, of course, you don't have a telephone or don't have things that they could have access to, like telephone.
Well, that makes it a whole lot harder, but these days they make it almost impossible for you to live without those things.
Yeah, that's true. All right, one other thing I'll let you go. Okay, I mentioned a computer, right. Is there also some type of, like the 958, is there some type of thing where you could dial someone's number and punch in a code and get number? That's number one. And number two, is there some type of book listed either by name or number or address that has unlisted numbers that the 9X or New York telephone makes?
Well, okay, the second question first.
Okay.
Now, when you call information and they say a number is unlisted, they cannot see that number. The number is there, but it's prevented from being seen on the computer.
Right, it's lit up in white. It's like the area where the number is supposed to be. It's like on a computer when a computer flashes a particular word, except you can't see the word. It's like a bar or something, a white bar.
I'm not sure exactly what it looks like, but the address
can't
does
see it.
The address does show up there, but the operator does not even see the number. But the number is there, it's just not being seen. The phone company obviously has all of this information, because how else would they bill people with unlisted phone numbers? So yes, it exists, it's there. It's just blocked out from certain people. Now, I wasn't quite sure I understood the first question where you said get somebody's phone number by dialing something.
Well, yeah, no, I was saying, okay, let's say somebody dials my house.
Uh-huh.
Let's say they dial my house. Is there some, like, similar to the 958, is there some type of service where...
Well, you're talking about caller ID.
No, not caller ID. I know that. That's on the receiver. No, there's a person that I would be the one that have that.
Okay.
But the person calling me, Can they punch in some type of code either after I pick up the phone or before, whatever?
Well, I don't understand. They're calling you. They already know what number they're calling, right?
What?
If they're calling you, they already know your number. Why would they want to punch
in? Oh, I'm sorry. Other information. Oh, right. I'm sorry. Now I'm getting mixed up.
Okay. That's not hard to do. I know.
Right. Yeah, I'm sorry. But there's no printed book, like a listed book. Is there an unlisted book?
Well, there is no book that is published and made available, but I'm sure that there are printouts that come out of the phone company that have all kinds of private information that probably just get chucked into the trash can. So, I mean, there are printouts, but I don't think there are books.
All right. Okay, well, I think you give enough.
Okay. Thanks
very
much for calling.
Oh, yeah, it's been very interesting, and I hope you do get enough pledges for this show. By the way, what's your amount, by the way?
It's embarrassingly low, and I don't think I even want to say it on the air, but please, people, please call up and make it higher, because if we don't do good here tonight...
You at least 100 grand in the past couple of weeks? No?
You know, I don't know what the total is for the last couple of weeks, but I do know the total for this show. It's staring me in the face, and it's making me feel miserable. So at least if we can get that number to go up a little bit more, I won't feel so bad when I slink out of here tonight.
Well, you know, I hope maybe somebody call up even if they pledge $5 or $10.
Every bit.
$10 here, $10 there. It adds up.
It sure does.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for calling.
Okay, I'll be there.
All right. We have lots of people out there, you know, in Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx, Nassau, Suffolk, and one person has called in on the pledge line. Thank you very much, whoever you may be. And sure, it'd be nice if people in Tally Room answered the phone. Okay, great. There are other lines, you know, they're starting to fall asleep in there. Give us a call, 212-279-3400, and show your support for WBAI. Help keep us going, because that's what we want to do. We want to be able to bring you information. We want to be able to bring you interviews. We're going to have the Steve Jackson interview coming up in just a couple of minutes. And all kinds of other bits of information. For instance, we were talking about ANAC numbers. 958 is the one that works for most of the area. If you're in Westchester, though, try 990, and that will probably give you your phone number. And there are other ones that work in different places, different areas, that give you that bit of information. That's not made public. You know, you have to learn that by either hearing it here or hearing it from other people as well. Another thing, maybe this will be a bit of fun for us to try throughout the night. Social Security numbers. You know, the previous caller was talking about finding people. Well, it's incredibly easy to find people now that we all have these little numerical names. Okay, and our Social Security numbers are our numerical names. We can't get rid of them. They follow us around from birth to death. You know? And there's something that kind of sad in that, because according to the law, those things are just for Social Security. Yet they're part of our every lives. The next few people that call in, you want to give me the first three digits of your Social Security number. No harm there. You know, I can't find out who you are by those first three digits. But I can tell you where you were born. How's that? The challenge accepted? Tell me what the first three digits of your Social Security number are. And, you know, I'm not sure if this will actually work. This might not work completely, but it probably will. So give us a call, 212-279-3407 for on-air calls, 212-279-3400 to make a pledge. Good morning.
Hi. Let me turn my radio off.
Okay.
Okay. First, the argument that AT&T is not obligated to divulge the phone numbers of its competitors is absurd if you consider that it's AT&T's business to provide phone numbers to the public.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And so I think there's no earthly reason to feel sorry for AT&T on that one, or to complain unfair competition. I've worked with people at 9X, and they freely acknowledge that AT&T is, to all intents and purposes, a monopoly. So, I think you're right. As far as card systems, though, and encouraging duplication of cards, it so happens I've written a smart card operating system for point of sale, and that's a concern of mine. That there are hackers going around or who would potentially want to destroy the contents of the cards, or at least hack them. And considering that one of the capabilities of these cards would be to provide third-party check cashing, circumventing banks, that's a bit of a concern. I've got to work on it.
Yeah, well, no, I should point out, though, that the hackers of the world, the vast majority of the hackers are not interested in destroying anything. They're simply interested in figuring out how to circumvent whatever system is in place. Now, if somebody were to use that knowledge to do something nasty, of course, that would be a criminal act, but I don't think that equates with hacking.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think hacking is sort of a natural human tendency to want to figure out a way. And I see it in people that that know nothing about computers, yet they kind of cheer when they hear about what a hacker is able to do, because the hacker is figuring out a way around, you know, the big guys, you know, AT&T and whatever.
Uh-huh. Well, it turns out, though, that it's it is surprisingly easy to break into the credit networks and so on. I'm just
right, and that's something that should be upsetting everybody, because it's information about you that's practically lying out there in the street, and I think that company should have some obligation to protect that data.
Okay, well, and that if you pursue it that way, then for the record, the credit networks are totally unprotected.
Right.
After speaking against hackers and so on, now I'm turning the other cheek. Okay. they're virtually totally unprotected. I know you gave out they're an ASCII. The part of the problem is that they're an association of banks, of thousands of banks, and it's almost impossible to get them to agree on anything. And so you have a situation where all this data is being transmitted over phone lines in ASCII.
Right.
Is it generally known? I think it is, that the interbank settlement networks are also unprotected.
Well, I can't say for sure.
Okay.
I would hasten to guess that the protection is not what it could be.
Okay. Okay. Then I think you've heard what I've heard. Let's see. You also mentioned a couple weeks back about the Mod 10 checksum on credit cards.
Yes. In fact, I'd like to get into that a little bit later, too.
So happens you left out a little detail.
What's that?
Well, you got the algorithm more or less right. As far as I recall, when I programmed that algorithm, that's the one I use, more or less.
Right.
Or something equivalent to it. But you left out, I think you mentioned that the first four digits refer to the issuer or the credit institution.
Well, with Visa and MasterCard, yes.
Yeah. But you left out a little gotcha, which is, my phone's falling all over the place, which is that the length of the card number is important.
Oh, yes, if it's odd or if it's even.
Well, yeah, but the number of digits, because most point-of-sale terminals will check the actual length. That is not just odd or even, that's true, but I believe the Sears card and either Visa or MasterCard have the same first four digits, but the length of one of them is a little longer.
Well, 16 is the general length of Discover,
right.
Visa and MasterCard. There are some Visas and MasterCards that are smaller than that. I believe 13.
13, that's correct.
So, and American Express is another strange number, I think 15?
Yeah, Chemical uses 17.
So
that's not on the same network.
It depends upon which, if it's odd or even, depending on which number you you add a certain amount of numbers to.
Right.
And then you divide the whole thing by 10, and if it's divisible, it's a valid number. That's
right.
Basically it.
Well, yeah. Actually, it's kind of small change trying to rip off the credit card companies with that, although I guess if you go below the floor limit, you can, you know.
Well, there are companies that do not check the actual credit.
They don't check, generally. It all goes through, let's see, basically the system is, it goes through these things called MIPS, front-end processors, that I think are Series 1s. And I believe they check a certain floor limit, and if you're below that, they won't send it out. to generally most of the transactions go, I think, up in Washington to a place called Deluxe Data. Is that right?
I don't know that.
I think that's right. Well, I might have gotten Deluxe Data wrong, but as far as I can recall, that's true. But there is a floor limit, so they don't even check below a certain number.
So I want to get to one or two more calls. Let me just ask you one final thing. Do you trust me with the first three digits of your Social Security number?
Yeah.
Okay, what are they?
123.
123?
Yeah.
You were born in New York, were you not?
Yes, okay. I was.
Okay. That's nothing to be ashamed of there. Thanks for calling.
And also, I'm a subscriber to WBAI.
Okay, well, make sure all your friends and neighbors are too, okay?
I don't talk to them.
Okay, well, it'd be a good way to break ground with them then. Thanks very much for calling.
Sure, bye.
212-279-3407 for call-ins. 212-279-3400 for pledges. We do need to get those pledges coming in because we have interviews coming up. We've got features coming up. We've got education coming up. But it can't continue unless we hear from you. Simple as that. 212-279-3400. If you've gotten something out of this program, if you've gotten something out of programs in the past, if you've gotten something out of anything on WBAI within the last couple of months, and I'm sure if you're listening now, you probably have. Well, you almost definitely have because there's so much here. You know, there's so much in the way of diverse programming. Here's something that that just came in. Actually, put this in the machine here. We're going to hear a program or a promotion for a program that's going to be coming up later on today. And this will give you an idea of the kinds of things that we have every day, 365 days a year here in WBAI. Your call at 212-279-3400 makes programs like this possible.
Tune in tonight for a special Radio Free Erin WBAI Marathon program. From 8:30 to 11 o'clock, we'll be featuring British parliamentarian Anthony Benn. We'll be discussing a wide range of issues, from Ireland to the Gulf War, to solutions to Britain's role in the ongoing occupation of Ireland's six northeast counties. Join Mick DeWan and John McDonough for this and more tonight at 8:30 on your listener-sponsored radio station, WBAI New York.
There you go. Just one example of the many different kinds of programs we have here in WBAI, but only available to you if you help us out and keep us going. Because if we don't reach our goals, it's going to chip away at the radio station that exists here. 212-279-3400. Let's get two more calls to make a pledge of whatever it is you can afford. For $65, you can get a WBAI t-shirt or a WBAI baseball cap. And every call, every pledge, will get a free copy of 2600 Magazine, the Hacker Quarterly, where we talk about all kinds of neat and interesting things. 212-279-3400. Let's take some more calls. Good evening.
Hi, Emmanuel. Good show.
Thank
as
you.
Usual. Everybody out there should pledge. It's really important. I have an article sitting here that was on my desk and says, send to Emmanuel Goldstein. And lo and behold, there you are on the radio. It's kind of interesting. The issue that you've sort of been discussing tonight is attempts on the part of the government or governments to limit our access to information. But they want a complete and total access to our information. There was an article, are you familiar with it, that was in the New York Times on 4/17/91 on page A16 titled, Move on Unscrambling of Messages is Assailed. Are you familiar with that?
No, I missed that one.
May I read the first paragraph or two?
Go ahead.
Okay, it reads, it's by John Markoff. A measure tucked inside a recently proposed Senate bill calls on telephone and computer companies give the government the means to unscramble private electronic messages and telephone conversations that have been encrypted to ensure privacy. The provision is defended as a way to prevent the concealment of illegal activity. but it has alarmed business executives and civil libertarians. And I'll skip down a little bit here. The Senate proposal calls on phone companies and computer equipment manufacturers to permit the government to obtain unscrambled voice and computer data transmissions when searches are authorized by law. The proposal is worded as a resolution in a counterterrorism bill introduced in January by Senator Joseph R. Biden, Jr., Democrat of Delaware. And I'll skip over to the last paragraph. But a number of civil liberties experts said that if such a resolution became law, computer makers and communications companies would be forced to place special trap doors in their products. These are special software entrances that would permit law enforcement officials to read scrambled text or voice messages. I remember back when the initial discussion of wiretapping was going on, and there was a big fight over whether they should allow any wiretapping at all on the part of the government. This is about, I don't know, 17 years ago, 18 years ago. And recently I read an article somewhere that there are now, 130, 140 federal agencies that are routinely tapping telephones and listening to PIN register stuff. And so this resolution, which although it uses the phrase authorized searches, that has not been the case with telephone data, and I'm sure it wouldn't be the case with computer data. And people should subscribe because this is the only place that you'll hear about stuff like this.
That's right. And it's something you'll see a lot more authorized searches in the future because it's going to be so much easier to do an authorized search.
But I just find it odd that if the government is so concerned with freedom and legality that they don't want me to look at anything, but they want to have a clean and open highway into anything I have, and then whether it's radio communications, telephone communications. It's interesting that I don't know if you've discussed it, that during the war, the first warnings were issued concerning packet ham radio communications to the coalition, as a matter of fact, by the FCC in Virginia, when they were, it was routinely being used by a variety of different sources, and they decided to clamp down on the commercial clauses and claim that the coalition was commercial and couldn't use packet ham transmissions.
Uh-huh.
I think they issued 7 or 8 citations to the coalition. Pretty insidious, but keep up the good work.
Thank you. And do you trust me with the first three numbers?
395. I'm waiting.
395, Wisconsin?
Very good. Very good.
Okay.
In fear.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Now, yes, if you trust me with the first three numbers of your Social Security number, I can probably tell you where you were born. Now, as a note up there, Rick Frost donated. Now, okay. Now, I don't know if that's a little dot there, but either Rick Frost donated $500 or he donated $5. I don't know which. But I hope it's not a clerical error in either direction. He's from Clifton, New Jersey. Okay, I'm sure they're making a correction on it right now. I have a feeling it's not $500. Okay, that is a dot there. $5, not $500. But if you want to donate $500, boy, think of, I won't have to say another word all night long probably. If somebody was nice enough to do that. And there's a lot of rich people out there. There really are. There are a lot of people that can, afford to donate a substantial amount to this radio station. But, we're not saying this to mock them or anything like that. We know there's a lot of rich people out there that have values that are worth something, that care about a radio station like WBAI. Think of the amount of good that you can do by making a pledge that will carry such weight. Now $5 pledges are great, and we're thankful for them, and we want to thank Rick for calling in. But we need lots of pledges. We need lots of $5 pledges, lots of $50 pledges, and those big pledges add up, and those little pledges add up. But we need to get those phone lines lit. 212-279-3400. Think of the bits of information that you would not get from other radio stations, from other sources, other media sources anywhere. It's true. You don't get them because commercial interests control just about every media outlet in this town. It's a sad fact, but it's a true fact. 212-279-3400. Show your support for non-commercial radio. Show your support for independent, free-thinking radio. And show your support for public access radio, because we give our listeners as much access as we can possibly give them. 212-279-3400. We have the Steve Jackson interview coming up in just a couple of minutes. Let's take one more phone call, and then we'll move over towards that direction. Good evening.
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
Okay, you mentioned before the caller ID. Now, we don't have that in New York at this time, right?
Not yet, although I'm sure it's going to come at some point, probably sometime in the next year.
Right. Now, I'm seeing commercials. It's only in Jersey so far.
Right. You're seeing those Bell Atlantic commercials.
Right. Now, there's no other way of doing that now, of finding out who's calling your number.
Not in New York, unless you get some kind of a trace put on your line, or unless you're able to convince them to call an 800 number, you can get their number that way.
Mention that. What is that all about?
Well,
I don't understand that. When you said you pay $20 more a month and you have an 800, what is that?
There's one company in particular, Cable and Wireless, that offers a service where you pay $20 a month and you can have a programmable 800 number. MCI has an 800 number too. Sprint has 800 numbers that you can get for fairly low prices. And when you after you pay your monthly fee, you pay for every call that comes in, obviously. What you do is you get kind of a reverse phone bill. You get the numbers of the people that call you. Since you're paying for the calls, you have the right to know who is calling you.
But now, in other words, the people would have to be dialing it as an 800 also, right?
That's right. Yeah, you'd have to give them that number and have them call that number, and then you can find out who is calling you.
Well, that would come under business. They would give you that for private use also.
That can be for private use, yes. MCI has a service known as Personal 800, and the other companies also offer similar services. I'm not certain about AT&T. I don't know if they offer something, but it's worth asking. It's certainly a valuable thing to have.
But the main reason for the ID would be to catch somebody that you really doesn't want to be known. In other words, you want to know who they are.
Well, I'll tell you, it's kind of a murky thing because, you know, anybody with any sense whatsoever will know that if they call from their home, they're likely to be caught if they're harassing somebody. Caller ID is not the answer that everybody is saying it is, because it's very easy to get around, and it always will be. People can call from pay phones. They can route their calls in various ways. They can circumvent the system. So it's not 100%. It's something, but I think it's more something for the phone companies than it is for us.
Yeah, how much do you think that would be a month when it comes into here?
Caller ID, I think it's something between $5 and $10 a month.
Would you get it?
I might get it just to experiment with it, just to see, you know, how I can make certain numbers show up and how I can defeat the system. So I would get it to play around with, but I would never depend upon it.
Right. Now, I've seen in the booklet here it said that it would only work if the person is calling you also from an area where it is hooked up.
Yeah, in fact, something about caller ID, it's pretty much restricted to your local area. I think that's the case in New Jersey. Perhaps somebody from New Jersey can call in and let us know this, but I'm pretty sure it's restricted to your central office. In other words, a person in southern New Jersey calling northern New Jersey is not going to show up as a caller ID.
Oh,
but
wow.
in the future, that certainly will be the case. We'll probably have nationwide caller ID.
Right, right.
So it is moving towards that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Our number is 212-279-3400. That's the number to call to make a pledge, and I cannot overemphasize the importance of making that pledge now. There's people driving, there's people trying to fall asleep that can't and are getting disturbed by all the troubling things they're hearing, and also people that are fascinated by all of this. But in order for us to be here next year, and to be here the year after that, and to continue to bring you programs like this, we need to hear from you. We really do. And if you can support us by using Visa and MasterCard, that's fine. It might make things a little bit easier for you. If you can support us by pledging whatever amount you feel is right, then please do that. 212-279-3400. Make that call, and get other people to make that call, too. We know it's late. We know it's the overnight period. But that's no reason not to make a call. It's no reason not to support your favorite radio station. We hope to see two more calls before we go into Steve Jackson. We have some information about Steve Jackson. First, we're going to do a little musical break. And do give us a call. 212-279-3400. office, there might be a document compromising the security of the 911 telephone system. In the months that followed, Jackson saw the business he had built up over many years dragged to the edge of bankruptcy. Steve Jackson Games was a successful and prestigious publisher of books and other materials used in adventure role-playing games. Jackson also operated a computer bulletin board system known as a BBS to communicate with his customers and writers and obtain feedback and suggestions on new gaming ideas. The bulletin board was also the repository of private electronic mail belonging to several of its users. This private mail was seized in the raid. Despite repeated requests for the return of his manuscripts and equipment, the Secret Service has refused to comply fully. And today, that date being May 1st, 1991, today, more than a year after that raid, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, acting with Steve Jackson Games owner Steve Jackson, has filed a precedent-setting civil suit against the United States Secret Service, Secret Service agents Timothy Foley and Barbara Golden, Assistant United States Attorney William Cook, and Henry Klupfel. "This is the most important case brought to date," said EFF General Counsel Mike Godwin, "to vindicate the constitutional rights of the users of computer-based communications technology. It will establish the constitutional dimension of electronic expression. It also will be one of the first cases that invokes the Electronic Communications and Privacy Act as a shield and not as a sword. An act that guarantees users of this digital medium the same privacy protections enjoyed by those who use the telephone and the U.S. mail." Commenting on the overall role of the Electronic Frontier Foundation in this case and other matters, EFF's President Mitch Kapor said, "We have been acting as an organization interested in defending the wrongly accused. But the Electronic Frontier Foundation is also going to be active in establishing broader principles. We begin with this case where the issues are clear. But behind this specific action, the EFF also believes that it is vital that government, private entities, and individuals who have violated the constitutional rights of individuals be held accountable for their actions. We also hope this case will help demystify the world of computer users to the general public and inform them about the potential of computer communities." With this case, the Electronic Frontier Foundation begins a new phase of affirmative legal action. In their press release, they say, "We intend to fight for broad constitutional protection for operators and users of computer bulletin boards. It is essential to establish the principle that computer bulletin boards and computer conferencing systems are entitled to the same First Amendment rights enjoyed by other media. It is also critical to establish that operators of bulletin boards, whether individuals or businesses, are not subject to unconstitutional, overbroad searches and seizures of any of the contents of their systems, including electronic mail." And the Electronic Frontier Foundation also believes that it is vital to hold government, private entities, and individuals who have violated the constitutional rights of others accountable for their actions. This lawsuit seeks to vindicate the rights of a small, successful entrepreneur publisher to conduct this entirely lawful business free of unjustified governmental interference. It is also the goal of this litigation to firmly establish the principle that lawful activities carried out with the aid of computer technology, including computer communications and publishing, are entitled to the same constitutional protections that have long been accorded to the print medium. Computers and modems, no less than printing presses, typewriters, the mail, and telephones, being the methods selected by Americans to communicate with one another, are all protected by our constitutional rights. Steve Jackson of Austin, Texas, is a successful small businessman. His company, Steve Jackson Games, is an award-winning publisher of adventure games and related books and magazines. In addition to its books and magazines, Steve Jackson Games operates an electronic bulletin board system known as the Illuminati BBS. It's operated for its customers and for others interested in adventure games and related literary genres. Also named as plaintiffs are various users of the Illuminati BBS. The professional interests of these users range from writing to computer technology. Although neither Jackson nor his company were suspected of any criminal activity, the company was rendered a near-fatal blow on March 1, 1990, when agents of the United States Secret Service, aided by other law enforcement officials, raided its office, seizing computer equipment necessary to the operation of its publishing business. The government seized the Illuminati BBS and all of the communications stored on it, including private electronic mail, shutting down the BBS for over a month. The Secret Service also seized publications protected by the First Amendment, including drafts of the about-to-be-released role-playing game, a book known as GURPS Cyberpunk. The publication of the book was substantially delayed while Steve Jackson Games employees rewrote it from older drafts. This fantasy game book, which one agent preposterously called a handbook for computer crime, has since sold over 16,000 copies and been nominated for a prestigious game industry award. No evidence of criminal activity was ever found. The warrant application, which remained sealed at the government's request for 7 months, reveals that the agents were investigating an employee of the company whom they believed to be engaged in activity they found questionable at his home and on his own time. The warrant application further reveals not only that the Secret Service had no reason to think any evidence of criminal activity would be found at Steve Jackson Games, but also that the government omitted telling the magistrate who issued the warrant that Steve Jackson Games was a publisher and that the contemplated raid would cause a prior restraint on constitutionally protected speech, publication, and association. The defendants in this case are the United States Secret Service and the individuals who, by planning and carrying out this grossly illegal search and seizure, abused the power conferred upon them by the federal government. Those individuals include Assistant United States Attorney William J. Cook, Secret Service agents Timothy Foley and Barbara Golden, as well as Henry Klupfel of Bellcor, who actively participated in the unlawful activities as an agent of the federal government. These defendants are the same individuals and entities responsible for the prosecution last year of electronic publisher Craig Nydorf. The government in that case charged that Nydorf's publication of materials concerning the enhanced 911 system constituted interstate transportation of stolen property. The prosecution was resolved in Nydorf's favor in July of 1990, when Nydorf demonstrated that materials he published were generally available to the public. This case is about the constitutional and statutory rights of publishers who conduct their activities in electronic media rather than in the traditional print and hard copy media, as well as the rights of individuals and companies that use computer technology to communicate, as well as to conduct personal and business affairs generally. The government's wholly unjustified raid on Steve Jackson Games and seizure of its books, magazines, and bulletin board system violated clearly established statutory and constitutional law, including the Privacy Protection Act of 1980, which generally prohibits the government from searching the offices of publishers for work product and other documents, including materials that are electronically stored. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech, of the press, and of association, and which prohibits the government from censoring publications, whether in printed or electronic media. The Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable governmental searches and seizures, including both general searches and searches conducted without probable cause, to believe that specific evidence of criminal activity will be found at the location searched. And the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and the Federal Wiretap Statute, which together prohibit the government from seizing electronic communications without justification and proper authorization. All that coming from the May 1st, 1991 edition of the Electronic Frontier Foundation publication, Effector. A lawsuit has been started. Legal action has finally been taken against the Secret Service for its actions. In this particular case, actions against Steve Jackson Games, but over the past few years, since 1984, actions against hackers, publishers, teenage kids, and things that have resulted in a very scary scenario. In just a moment, we'll hear from Steve Jackson himself. If you believe in free speech on the air, on the FM dial in New York, please show your support now for WBAI at 212-279-3400. We're speaking with Steve Jackson, who is the founder, owner, and president of Steve Jackson Games in Austin, Texas. Steve, good evening.
Good evening.
You had quite a bit of a hassle over the past year with the Secret Service and a whole big case that concerned computer hackers and all kinds of alleged conspiracies. Now, first of all, could you tell us what exactly is Steve Jackson Games?
We publish role-playing games and board games and magazines about games. We do not publish computer games. That's one of the errors that keeps getting into the press reports. Everything that we produce is printed on paper.
Okay. Now, we'll get back to that, I guess, in a few minutes. But why don't you start by telling us what exactly happened to you last year, with as many specific dates as possible. I believe it was just about a little over a year ago that things started happening.
Yes, actually 14 or 15 months now. This happened on March 1st. What happened was that early in the morning, my offices were invaded by agents of the United States Secret Service. They had sort of a search warrant. The copy that they left us didn't have a judge's signature, and most of the blanks on it weren't filled in, but nobody here wanted to argue with them. They spent several hours going through the building. They went through desks. They tore open boxes in the warehouse. They forced open file cabinets and lockers. They used bolt cutters to take the locks off our storage units, while the employee with the keys stood there offering to open them for them, and so on and so on and so on. They pretty well tore things up around here. When they left, they took three of our computers, they took a laser printer, they took a lot of assorted hardware, and lots and lots and lots of disks and papers and business data. And in particular, they took every current copy on either paper or disk of the new book that we were about to send to the printer. At the same time they were doing this, they were raiding the home of my managing editor, who wrote that book. They took his computer, his laser printer, and every copy of the manuscript that he had.
Now, throughout all of this, were you given an explanation as to just what exactly was going on?
The only explanation that they would give was to point to the warrant, which had some vague language in it about investigation of computer crime. Other than that, they wouldn't comment. And when people called our office on the phone during the time they were there, the agents who were answering the phone were not informative at all. They would do things like pick up the phone and say, call back later, and hang up again.
How long did this whole process take?
They were in there for several hours.
Now, can you describe for us the aftermath of that one day?
Well, we're still going through the aftermath, but taking it a step at a time. As soon as I had some idea of what was really happening, I called a lawyer here in town who does our trademark work, and I told him, "You're not going to believe this, but the Secret Service, you know, is raiding my office. Can you put me in touch with somebody who knows about things like this?" And they got me in touch with an attorney in Dallas who specialized in federal criminal procedure. And he called the Secret Service and talked to them and notified them that among the things that they had scooped up was data that we had to have in order to stay in business. And the attorney asked if we could get copies of our material, and the Secret Service told him yes. So the next morning, I'm down at the Austin office of the Secret Service with a big box of blank disks and with an attorney accompanying me, and it was a very interesting experience. I did not get very many files back. They let me have two disks worth of files. I was not allowed to make any copies myself. Of the machines that they had down there of ours, I was only allowed to have copies from one of the machines. The others they just refused to consider making any copies from.
Did they say why?
This might be evidence. Which doesn't make any sense, but that's what they said.
Was there anything different about those particular files?
Well, they were all different machines used for different purposes. One of the machines that they took, one of the computers, was our bulletin board system, our electronic BBS. And they refused to let me have any copies of anything off that.
And what kind of things were going on the bulletin board?
This bulletin board was used to discuss our games, both the ones that were already out and games that were in progress. In particular, one file on there that I really needed was a file of playtester comments on the GURPS Cyberpunk game, which is the one that they confiscated all the copies of. It would have been a lot easier to reconstruct the book, which is what we eventually had to do, was reconstruct it, if we had been able to get the copies of the playtester comments. But they wouldn't let us have those. All the copies that I was allowed to have after that session were copies that were made by a Secret Service agent who did not know how to use computers. He sat there at the keyboard, and he would ask me what commands to type in order to look at things and get the copies made. I would tell him the command. Then he would holler across the room to another agent who apparently understood computers to see if the instruction was all right. And the other guy would say, "Yeah, sure," and then this guy would type something in.
What kind of commands are we talking about here?
Oh, we're talking about saying, "Type DIR to get a directory."
And he would shout across the room, "DIR," to make sure that that was the proper command.
Right. And then and the other guy would say, "Yeah, sure," and then this guy would type DIR. And then nothing would happen because he hadn't entered return. So I would say, "Now hit return." He would say, "He wants me to hit return." The other agent would say, yeah, hit return, and then he'd hit return, and then the directory would come up. And it was like this. I mean, just every file that I wanted had to be made with this kind of process.
So how long were you down there for?
About an hour and a half. That was all the time they'd let me have. They said that after that, it had to be flown, it had to be flown to Chicago where the experts could look at it.
Who apparently knew how to type DIR and hit return. Can you describe from the beginning, what was the level of competence of the agents who raided you? You've already described the agents that were processing the data. Was it pretty consistent like this?
Well, I'm not an expert on raids. These... I have been told by other people that, based on the description of the way they went through the building, this is what you would expect from a drug bust.
How so?
But I've never been through a drug bust either.
Well,
so
can you describe...
Just in terms of hostility to the people who they wouldn't let in the building, in terms of tearing up the premises, in terms of just carting away loads and loads of stuff that they didn't need.
Uh-huh. Did they take your telephone?
No, they didn't take the telephone. I understand that other people who were raided in the same series had telephones and tape recorders taken. They did take our laser printer.
I see.
There was one theory that they thought they could read the ribbon on it.
Now, when you were asking them, well, what's going on here, did they come up with any particular ridiculous scenario? I know in some particular cases they would accuse the people of having caused the AT&T network to crash and moving satellites around in the sky. Did they have any kind of scenario like that for you?
Not that they would give us at the time. There was some really ridiculous stuff in the warrant, or in the application that they filed with the judge in order to get their search warrant on us. But all that was sealed. Nobody saw that for many months afterwards.
But you did see that. What was in it when you did see it?
It contained the same kind of allegations that they made against Craig Nydorf that were just exploded at his trial, talking about the 911 file as though it were a program, which it's not, and as though it were worth a great deal of money, which it's not, and just in general trying to make a huge, frightening hacker conspiracy out of nothing.
Now, have you had experiences with computer hackers before, and if so, how do you compare them to what the agents were alleging?
Well, what the agents actually did was like but worse what the agents say hackers do. I mean, the scare stories that they tell are that if hackers get into your system, they might damage your hardware and destroy files and keep you from being able to use your system for a long time. That's what they say about hackers. But what the Secret Service agents did to me was damage my hardware, destroy my files, and keep me from using the systems for a long time. So I think I got hacked, but I got hacked by the Secret Service.
It's rather a rude awakening. Now, now you're suing the Secret Service, so can you describe to us what exactly is involved in that? What are you trying to get back from them? And what is it that they have taken from you?
Well, they have never returned either all of the files or all of the hardware that they took. They claim that they have, but that's not true. Some of the equipment that they returned to us when they finally got around to giving us anything back was badly damaged. Of the three computers that they took, one was just destroyed. I mean, it's not usable. Another one was damaged, but we spent some money and got it fixed. Please tell them I'll call them back.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's see. The complaint itself is filed under several different laws. And essentially... Well, I've got a copy of the complaint in front of me, but I'm trying to get through enough of the legalese. Well, okay, just from memory. It's filed under the First Amendment because they closed down a bulletin board system which interfered with freedom of speech here. It interfered both with my freedom of speech and with the freedom of speech of the users of the BBS. And some of the users of the board are joining us in this complaint.
Now, did their action violate the ECPA?
Yes, it also violated the ECPA, and we are also suing them under the ECPA. That's the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and that essentially says, thou shalt not mess with electronic communications. thou shalt not steal email. And when they took away the BBS, they deprived a lot of the users of their unread electronic mail.
And if nothing else, if they do seize electronic mail, they're required to notify the people, are they not?
That's right.
And they never did.
That's right. They didn't follow any of the procedures that they should have followed. They are being sued under the Fourth Amendment as well, which is unreasonable search and seizure, because the grounds under which they raided us were grossly improper. They didn't have anything like probable cause to come into this office and search for evidence. And the warrant was incredibly overbroad. The way the warrant was written, it essentially said, you can go into this office and take any computer or anything that has anything to do with computers or any business record that has anything to do with the purchase of computers. And there were a few other things in there, but that's the high point.
Now, has there been a lawsuit like this in the past against a governmental agency for such a thing?
No, this one is going to be precedent-setting. It really is, as far as I know, the first of its kind. There have been cases before where a bulletin board operator was harassed unreasonably, but none of them have been federal cases.
Now, your book, GURP Cyberpunk, as you mentioned before, was affected greatly by this. They seized the copies and you had to reconstruct it.
Yes.
Now, that was eventually put out. Would you say that that the book itself has been put out the way you want it to be put out, finally?
Pretty much, I think. If we ever get back all the missing files, then we'll be able to see, okay, what did we forget about the second time when we redid it? And what did we think of that we might not have thought of the first time? And it'll be interesting to see at that point, even though it'll be like looking at ancient history.
Uh-huh.
We did get the book out, and it did get good reactions. It was 6 weeks late when it came out, and that 6 weeks had a domino effect on our schedule and our budget that really hurt us. But the book's out, and it's a good one. It has been nominated for Best Role-Playing Supplement of the Year, and we'll know it July 4th weekend is when those awards are announced, so then we'll know if it won. But it's a good book. I'm pleased with it.
Now, when this first began happening, the first press, I guess you would say, or the first mention, the first words of outrage came from the hacker community, the BBS community. It was passed around on the internet. And the same words of horror were expressed towards the other cases. You mentioned the Craig Nydorf case and a couple of other cases that were happening at the same time. Now, this eventually got into printed media. It led to the formation of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Is that a correct interpretation in your view?
Yes, I don't think that my case was the only one that inspired the creation of the EFF, because there are a lot of abuses out there, and they're addressing a lot of different abuses, but this was certainly one of them. The EFF certainly came into being at the right time to help me. I'm sure that I would not have gotten my hardware back if the EFF had not appeared, because it was very funny, really. After months of stonewalling and promising falsely that we'd have our equipment back immediately, the Secret Service suddenly popped up and returned it just a few days after it leaked to the press that the EFF was going to be taking an interest in my case.
Now, before this had happened to you, had you been aware of the series of Secret Service raids that have been taking place over the last few years, and prior to that, FBI raids on suspected computer hackers or bulletin boards that might contain messages about computer hacking?
Only peripherally. I had been a system operator for a long time, you know, of a BBS, so I had an interest in SysOp rights and SysOp responsibilities, but I certainly never thought it was going to come that close to home.
So has your view on the entire world of cyberspace changed now?
Yes, very much so. I'm now very painfully aware that law enforcement as a whole has not kept up with technology, that there are some law enforcement people out there who are very, very skilled, very knowledgeable, and their voices crying in the wilderness looking for improvement, that there are other law enforcement agents out there who don't understand the technology, don't want to understand it, they're afraid of it, and they're afraid of anyone who is a master of it.
Now, why do you see that as the case? Is it simply because they don't understand the technology?
Yes. It's very easy to fear something that you don't understand, especially when it's something as potentially powerful as this. So if you're a law enforcement agent and you don't understand computer technology, then you're going to believe everything that you hear. If someone tells you hackers can listen into your phone conversations, you'll believe it. If they say hackers can move satellites around, you believe it. Hackers are going to close down the 911 system. You believe it. Hackers are going to turn the moon into spam. And then they're going to drop it on New York. And you believe it. Because you don't know what these wicked hackers can do. But you know that computers are very powerful. And you don't know anything about them. So you think these guys are wizards. You believe any story that you hear. And then these fellows go around and they meet and they swap terrible stories. And they convince each other of all this nonsense. And the real computer crackers and the wannabe computer crackers, even worse, just feed this because they tell stories about the things they can do. And if you're a 14-year-old computer whiz, you might think it's real funny to get on a bulletin board and say, yes, I can turn the moon into spam, and tomorrow my buddies and I are going to do it. And if you know that there's a G-man on the board, a Secret Service agent, who believes all this stuff, you think that's real funny, because it is real funny. You're pulling this great con on the cops, except it isn't so funny when they believe it and they raid your house with their guns out and they say, we're going to confiscate your computers and your spam.
Now, short of the kind of firsthand knowledge that you've had with the whole process and the lack of understanding of technology on the part of government agents, how can the average person become educated as to what's really going on?
That's a hard one.
Well, I mean, is reading a newspaper, is that enough? Is listening to the radio enough, or should people be doing more?
Well, the best way, if you're really interested, is to get online yourself. Get a computer, get a modem, tap into bulletin boards. Which
is not illegal, by the way. A lot of people seem to think that every time you tap into something electronically, you're about to commit some kind of a crime.
Oh, that's what they're for. There are lots and lots and lots of public bulletin boards for all kinds of special interests. And if you don't see the one you want, you can start it yourself. Bulletin boards are the greatest thing for freedom of speech and communication since the invention of the photocopier. They make everyone not only into their own publisher, but they let everyone set up an open forum where other people can discuss. It's really wonderful. I mean, bulletin boards let everybody talk to everybody about everything, about anything they want to. There's no way that government or corporations or anybody else, I mean, whatever your favorite evil conspiracy is, there's no way that your favorite evil conspiracy can manage the news when everyone is tied into the net, when everyone is talking with people all over the world on bulletin boards via modems. That's where you can find out what's happening.
We've been speaking with Steve Jackson, who is the president, owner, founder of Steve Jackson Games. Steve, you mentioned earlier that you're not a computer game publisher. Now, you've been called that in the press many times. Is there a reason why, and also why do you feel it's important to make that distinction?
It started, I think, just from one error. The reporter for my local paper just got it wrong when he wrote the first report about it. apparently he thought we were a computer game publisher because the book GURP Cyberpunk had something to do with computers. And it was a natural error, but then the Associated Press picked it up from him, and then USA Today picks it up from Associated Press. And the next thing you know, it's one of these things that everybody believes because they have seen it in the paper. And I think that it's important, mostly just because it's such a great example of how once a false fact gets into the media, it's so difficult to get it out. It doesn't really have any bearing on the case at all. What the Secret Service did would have been just as bad, no more and no less bad, if I had been a computer game publisher. The interesting thing is that it could have happened to any, it could have happened to any company. It wasn't even necessary that I be a publisher. For instance, let's say that you run an auto parts store. Well, you have a computer in your auto parts store. You can't keep track of your stock without it. And let's say that the police suspect one of your employees of, say, being a bookie. Some nice, old-fashioned crime. And if this case goes the wrong way, we might find out that the police have a perfect right to come and confiscate the computer in your auto parts store just to see if by some chance the man who was suspected of being a bookie had left any incriminating information on it. Now, that's just the same as getting a warrant to come and take away every file cabinet in your office, just because the man might have put a piece of paper in there. But it doesn't necessarily look that way to law enforcement people who are not used to thinking of a computer as everything that it is. And I got way off the question there, because the original question was, why does it make a difference that I'm not a computer game thing? It doesn't make a difference to the case. It makes a difference because I'm interested in the media, I'm interested in getting the facts right, and it drives me crazy when I see a mistake repeated over and over again.
Well, at least they're spelling your name right. I know Craig Neidorf has taken issue with that particular case.
Yes, and then they always pronounce his name wrong, too.
Of course. Steve, now, how can people get involved in this if they want to help out?
Well, eventually, the Electronic Frontier Foundation will be accepting memberships and donations. They're not set up to do that yet. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is essentially, if you'll pardon a quick and dirty comparison, it's a high-tech ACLU. It's been set up to fight for civil liberties in the high-tech arena. And it does have the full cooperation of the ACLU. These are not competing groups. The EFF is just taking computer and high-tech related cases and dealing with them. So I would say read the papers, watch the net, and when you find out that the EFF has its tax papers finished, then join. There's also a phone number that I will try to locate here while I'm talking. Pardon me. See if I can do two things at once and find this on my computer.
Well, I'll tell you what. Since we're on tape, I'll have plenty of time to actually find that, and I'll come on live right after this and tell that phone number.
Okay. Sounds good. Then forget I said this.
Okay. Going to be appearing, I guess, on various places, various conferences and things like that?
Yes. I'm going to be at FIDOCON, which is a conference of bulletin board operators, in Boulder, Colorado, in a couple of months. And I expect I will be coming to other computer-related conferences, as time and money allow, to talk about the case and to learn more about other people's cases.
Well, let's hope that it remains news, and let's hope that the people listening are becoming educated on the issues, and when they see something on this, they'll ask plenty of questions.
I hope so. It's an important case. Computers are going to be more important in the next 20 years than anybody can imagine. And we absolutely have to nail down the fact that all of our constitutional rights still apply, that the Constitution doesn't go away just because there's a computer in the room.
Okay. Thanks very much for being with us tonight, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve Jackson from Steve Jackson Games here on WBAI. And that interview was taped earlier tonight, and Steve Jackson has been through hell fighting for his rights under the First Amendment, fighting for the right to keep his business afloat. And I remember we were on here about a year ago, a little more than a year ago, talking to Steve Jackson when this first happened. And we talked to Craig Neidorf when he was going through his problems. And it's a scary thing, you know, because we in the computer hacker world, and Steve Jackson's not even in the computer hacker world, but we who follow the details, we're on the front line, you know, and it's something when you have goons from the Secret Service and other agencies coming and tearing down people's doors and taking electronic equipment, taking people's answering machines and telephones and not knowing the first thing about technology, just knowing that the people that they suspect of doing something are evil people, people that are the witches of the 1990s, people to be feared, people who are not understood. And these are the folks that are going around implementing policies. It's a really scary scenario. A really scary scenario. Thank God there's something positive coming out of this now. And I am very happy, very pleased that people such as Steve Jackson and Craig Neidorf had the guts to stick it out and to fight because they knew they were right. How many of us have that same drive where we would stand up and fight something that is unjust? You have to wonder. You have to wonder how many people could actually do it. It's something that's going to keep being updated here on this radio station. And as promised, that phone number that we're going to give you for the Electronic Frontier Foundation is area code 617-864-1550. Folks, it's important. It's important that we all join hands and fight injustice whenever we see it. And a lot of us don't understand the actual workings of technology. You know, we want to know what's a computer bulletin board anyway. And basically, it's a gathering of people electronically. We all need to go out there and do this. We need to experience it. Why? Because this is something that's going to become more and more important as the years go by. More and more things are going to become electronic rather than paper. And if the First Amendment and the right of freedom of speech and the right of freedom of assembly, if that's not guaranteed electronically, you might as well say it's not going to be guaranteed at all. Folks, we need to hear from you. We need to get some pledges coming in so we can continue to bring you things like this in the future, because the future is going to be, well, interesting is a nice word. Scary is a not so nice word. There are changes happening. There are people that want to make things different. They want to shut down publications, bulletin boards, businesses. And it's scary to think of the power that they have to do just that. Because that's how a lot of the system works. You know, power is everything. And if you have power, you can get around inconvenient things like the Constitution and the First Amendment. This is something that we have strived to stand up for and to bring you instances where violations are reported. Now, how many other places did you hear about Steve Jackson Games? You know, this is something that we covered on WBAI throughout. as it was happening, and now as it's turning around, as the victim is actually fighting back. Now, had WBAI not been around for that, it would have been one less stone to throw at the enemy. You know, every bit of media attention is important, and the commercial media just does not understand how technology works, as almost as much as government agents don't understand how technology actually works. It's something that everybody has to be educated about, and a lot of the pressures of commercial radio and of corporate life doesn't allow for a lot of education to be going on. Here at WBAI, we try to get the word out. We try to educate people and explain things, and allow for lots and lots of questions. We're going to take some more phone calls in just a couple of minutes, 212-279-3407. But first, we'd like to see some activity on the pledge line, which is 212-279-3400. Reason for this, we're not just asking for money to line our pockets. We don't line our pockets around here, at least not with money. We line it with, leaflets and papers and notices and things like that, because we want to remain informed, educated,